like 20 years ago. I'm watching.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to convene the March 10, 2015 meeting of the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources.
Good friends.
Welcome to everyone. We have a couple of bills and a work session scheduled for today. The first bill I'm going to open a public hearing on is House Bill 2053. Mr. Gallagher, can you tell us a little bit about this bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2053 directs the State Department of Fish and Wildlife to establish a trophy trout lake pilot program, funds the program with a dollar surcharge on angling licenses, and requires the department to conduct studies and report to the legislature.
Very good. Thank you very much. And Vice Chair Krieger tells me that Joe and Tom, I guess, are going to do the introduction for this bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, gentlemen.
My name is Joe Rollator. I represent Desert Springs Trout Farm today. And with me is the president of Desert Springs Trout Farm, which is a large trout growing facility in near Lakeview, Oregon. They have an artesian water source. They grow very nice fish. But success working with the county in Mono County, California, which is up by Yosemite, to use stocking of large trout as an economic development tool for the county. And I've asked Tom to come in and talk to you a little bit about his particular program. But before I start that, I want to talk a little bit about the bill. For a couple of years now, a lot of us have been talking about ways to increase revenue for ODF&W. And the idea that we would have a trophy program has been something that a lot of people have talked about. We all know that there are farms all over Oregon where the farmer stocks a pond and charges $150 a day to come in and fish. There's a little pond up by Neskowin that the hatchery puts fish in from time to time, and it's a very productive farm. And if you know about it, you know how to get across the river there, you can go in there to public property. It's really incredible fishing. So when we drafted this bill, we put something on the table. It may not be the right vehicle. It may not be the right price. But the idea works other places, and we'd like to try it here in Oregon. Tom?
Very good.
Yes. Tom McDonald from Desert Springs Trout Farm.
Good morning.
The booklet that you have there, this is the county booklet, and when you turn the pages, you'll see all the lakes, and we stock all those lakes down there. And we've really extended our program into bigger fish. And the biggest fish we put in there are 12 pounds. And it's about a 9.5 hour run down there to deliver the fish. We've lost less than 1% on all of our runs. And I put a bill in there for you to look at, too, of one of the outfits in California that buys trophy fish from us. They buy 3-pound, 4, 5s, and 8 to 10s, and it's a lodge that's down by Bernie, California. And then there's a letter in there from the county on what the economic value is back to the county for the stocking program that we're doing down there. And then the last page is a list of all of the lakes and streams that we do stock down there. We have really expanded our program into the larger fish because that's what these states are really going after more now. Oregon's not yet, but I mean California is. We have also a pretty extensive meat market fish that we deliver into San Francisco, and it's it has a special diet. No animal byproducts or no fish products in it. We use pistachio nuts, pistachio oil, grains, and soybean in it. And we have one other we're working that uses a black fly larvae that we get out of Canada that's ground into the feed, so you don't have any byproducts of fish or animal byproducts in the feed. And the program is working very well, and it's going to get expanded more this year. And we've really been pushing on this big fish market because that's what everybody likes to catch. That first picture you see there, that guy's been fishing 40 years, and that's one of our fish that he's caught right there, the big one. And so that's what we've been doing at Desert Springs.
Mr. Chair, the aquaculture industry in Oregon, the inland aquaculture industry in Oregon, has developed around the business plan of growing small fish and outplanting them to ponds for bigger fish to grow. But recently, the Department of Agriculture, Oregon Department of Agriculture, has started to work with us. And it's not just Desert Springs that's capable of growing these fish. There are other trout farms in Oregon now that are doing a very similar product. And it's a combination of a live fish market where they deliver the fish in a truck in the water to the market. The market butchers them and then sells them immediately as fresh fish. And then stocking large fish for people to catch and release several times. So it's not just this one particular farm that can do this. The whole aquaculture industry in Oregon is growing into being capable of growing large fish like this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger.
What was the reason you wanted to have a vegetarian fish? That's what it really is.
There's a tremendous market out there, and people don't want animal byproducts in their feed. And so we've been working about 3 years now on this diet. We have tried a bunch of different ones, and the vegetarian diet with the pistachios, and it seems to be, and the pistachio oil seems to be, we get the same growth weight as we do on the other ones. Most of your fish feed has feather meal, chicken byproducts, chicken oil in it, and it really grows the fish fast, but they don't want it. And then if you read any of their stuff, they say by 2050 the oceans are going to be depleted for using sardines and herring and anchovies in feed. And there's a huge push to stop using animal byproducts in any fish feed. So we've jumped the gun on it to come up with a food source that we like that works and grows at the same rate that our other feed, that's darn near double in cost, but you can make the cost up on the meat market with it that way.
Chair,
please.
When you come down here in a couple of weeks to chase the wily turkey,
yes.
There's some of his fish in my pond that are between 7 and 8 pounds.
Yeah, they're really about this big.
Oh, my.
You know, he's telling the fish story.
Well.
Fish story?
So I have, Vice Chair Krieger, I have that wily bird. I have, I've been down with Representative Esquivel when we have chased. I was hoping that we would.
Well, you do a lot of chasing and not a lot of.
Okay.
And one other quick thing. We're going to expand the facility by another 150,000 pounds this year.
Wonderful.
Tom, I'm curious. How does the pistachio feed along with other things, how does it impact the flavor of the meat?
It doesn't seem to have any impact on the flavor of the meat. And the Portland market, the fish have been flowing from San Francisco to Portland, and we're going to be going into the Portland market directly from our place here, I'd say within the next month or two. It's all coming out of San Francisco right now, but that market in Portland, they feel, is a bigger market than the San Francisco market is.
And what about the color of the flesh?
It's pink.
It is?
Yeah. Hmm. And it's, you know, it's been quite a process to go through to get to this, because we did it on our dime. We didn't.
Yeah.
We had Rick Barrows from USDA in Bozeman, Montana, help us with the program, because that's all they do is research feed there in Bozeman at the research center. And so he has been the main man behind it to get to the stuff and to get to the omega-3s and stuff we wanted. We went to the pistachio, and it's the little broken pieces and stuff that come off of the nuts that can't be sold is what is ground up is what we put in the feed.
Okay. Very, very good. Representative Frederick.
Yes, I'm curious about the black fly.
Black fly larvae?
Larvae. Now, are you getting that from Canada? Is that what you
yes.
said?
Yes.
And why is there no U.S. source any for
None.
It at all?
This is the only source we found of this. I think you're going to see a lot more of it, but it's like 34% protein and 32% fat. So it's a really good source and it's growing in Canada in a farm there. And freeze dried, and then we mix it in with our feed.
So, to be truly technical, it's not you are still feeding an animal, but it's a different.
It doesn't fall under that category.
I understand.
And it's growing in different conditions than having your chicken products in there and your fish meal.
Well, and the concern in terms of the chicken products was probably also antibiotics and
That's
a few
right.
other things.
Exactly. That is exactly right.
Okay.
They say that it's out of there, but none of us have ever felt that you could get it completely out the way, because chickens are raised mainly on with a lot of antibiotics.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate
thank
getting
you.
That.
Yes, Vice Chair McLean.
My only question was that it indicated that you're trying for 4 trophy trout lakes, and so I was just wondering how do you, it's a private situation, do you have the 4 trout lakes in Oregon?
No, we do not. That would be up to Oregon Department of Fish and Game to decide which 4 lakes that they would use.
Mm-hmm. But I mean they're private or they're public?
They're public.
Okay.
We've proposed this. This is a model that's already working
okay.
on private ponds.
Okay.
And Representative Witt put together a group of us to try to think about ways to increase the revenue to ODF&W, and I think this is one.
Mm-hmm.
So we do this in ponds that are open to the public, that have access for kids, and like the little boy in the picture here, has a chance, a fairly decent chance, of catching a fish bigger than a couple of pounds.
Thank you.
Additional questions or comments? Yes, Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the bill, it says a program with a large number of 2 to 8 pound trout. So what is a large number? You know, if you're putting them in I don't know how big these lakes are, if they're a 5-acre lake or a 100-acre lake, you know, do you recommend so many fish per acre of
Yes. The way we kind of vision it is as you come up with a mount working with ODF&W that you would stock, and then it would be tracked, and as the fish started sliding off, then you would keep putting more in to. So you've got the opportunity for people to catch fish.
Down in these lakes are. Oh. Follow
Please.
Up. Down in these lakes, are they catch and release, keep so many, just limits as in a regular limit in a trout lake, or if they catch like a 18-pounder, like whatever that guy caught, I mean, one per lifetime or one per year, do they limit that?
They're not limited at all.
Okay.
And these fish are sterile. They don't reproduce. So it's... And the reason for that was we do plan in streams down in California that do have some wild fish in them, so they're trying to still have a fishery and still trying to protect what wild stocks are still left in there. And one other thing, California Fish and Game this year is cutting their stocking program by 40% and cutting the fish that they stock size in half, which is going to be huge for California.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why are the fish sterile?
What's
and
that?
How did they become sterile?
The triploid. Right,
they're put under 9,000 pounds of pressure, and it makes the egg sterile. And there's no genetically altering these fish. It's just using pressure. And it's developed by Trout Lodge, where we buy our eggs from, and that's how they're made sterile that way.
Mr. Chair, Representative Escobar, they grow faster. They don't fight. They don't get soft-meated when they get ready to spawn because they don't spawn. Right. And they'll continue to grow for a long time. So they're just, whenever you see a 20-pound-plus rainbow trout from the Midwest, those are all hybrids that were planted about 5 to 10 years ago. Hybrid rainbow trout that were planted about 10 years ago. Now people are starting to catch them as 20-pound fish. You see them in the fishing magazines every once in a while.
Additional questions or comments? Well, gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your appearance and your testimony. I'd like to call up, please, next, Tom Wolf and Jim Myron. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Chair Witt, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, the executive director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. I'm here to give Trout Unlimited's support for House Bill 2053 with two comments that we'd like to see, things that we'd like to see looked at in this bill. And I want to start off with a fact, with a little bit of history. You know, Oregon is often seen as the land of steelhead and salmon, and of course a few trout streams like the McKenzie and Deschutes. But what is unknown to the vast majority of people, that if you go east of the Cascades, because the water is so alkaline, the lakes there produce massive numbers of fish and are some of the best lake fishing not only in the United States but in the world. And I was at Lava Lake, which is a public lake south of Bend, in May, and caught, you know, this because it's my style to catch and release, but I caught 40 fish in 5 hours. Between 18 to 25 inches, between 2 to 8 pounds. And I saw people who were fishing with bait catch and keep fish. I've been to places like East Lake, that's the same thing. So we have, there's tremendous amount of, the lakes can produce a lot of fish. They say in some of those lakes, the trout, when they're put in there, grow an inch a month. You know, they grow, they're put in as fingerlings, and within like a year, they're 16 inches. So there's it's a tremendous thing. And another thing that's happening is because ranchers have recognized in eastern Oregon that their ponds, because they're alkaline, provide a tremendous source. There's a lot of ranchers that have started stocking their ponds with fish and opened them up to the public, either as a catch and release fisherman for rich fly fishermen, unlike me, who's a poor fly fisherman, and then also to people to catch and keep, and possibly using some of Tom's fish. So it's a tremendous opportunity that provides income to a lot of ranchers to help them, you know, keep their ranch going. So my two caveats to 2053, and I think it's a great concept. It should go forward. I think it has a great potential because of the reasons I just stated. But there's two things. One, I'm worried about the cost of stocking 2 to 8 pound fish in lakes because they're more expensive to raise than fingerlings. And, you know, maybe my concerns can be alleviated and they can show that it wouldn't be that expensive, and that's fine. Second is a dollar surcharge and license. I believe with a license increase that we're going to be facing in this session that ODFW is asking for, I think that's just asking too much. I think we could look at other ways to fund this program, but I think it's a great idea to target a fishery in Oregon, trophy lake fishing, that is just unknown by the vast majority of people, that brings into the economy around those lakes, tremendous amount of money for businesses. So I think this is a great idea. Hopefully my concerns can be addressed, but I think we should go forward with it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name is Jim Meyer, and I'm here representing Native Fish Society. And we, too, support the concept in this bill. It's similar to something that we tried a few years ago with that we called our Quality Waters Program that ended up with a report from the department on the potential, but it had a pretty good price tag along with it, yeah. So it never occurred. But, so from that standpoint, we support the bill. We have some concerns about the funding source. We think that adding more license cost onto what's already in front of you now with the department's proposal and with the hatchery research proposal, we think that's probably enough on the license side of things. So we would suggest that either the costs be absorbed within the existing fish hatchery program by reprioritizing some of those programs, or potentially having a specific fee just on the anglers that fish in these trophy lakes. You could have a $2 a day or $10 a year tag like you do, similar to a salmon steelhead tag, and just charge it to those that fish those, if it's four lakes or six lakes, whatever it is. And, you know, depending on which lakes you use, you could generate a lot of revenue with a specific tag like that. So anyway, that's where we are, and hope the bill moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions or comments? So, yes, Representative Esquivel.
I share your concern about lakes that we have, because I can think of a half a dozen lakes you can catch trout that are 5 pounds and up. One of them, the closest one to us, is Klamath. Smallest fish I've ever caught out there, 7 pounds. And then they go up from there. Then you have Cultus, you have Lava Lake, you have Crane Prairie, you have, I mean, large fish. Crane Prairie itself is probably a 7-8 pound plus lake during the summertime. So there's some substantially large. Wikiup's another one. I think the record out of there is 20-some pound German brown. That's a sizable fish. So, anyway, they used a harpoon on him, but they got him.
Additional questions or comments? I'm not seeing any. Gentlemen, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
All right, next I'd like to call up, please, Brett Brownscombe and Stan Steele.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning. Morning.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, thank you. And for the record, Brett Brownscombe, with Acting Deputy Director with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. What I wanted to do is just cover briefly what the department is currently doing related to trophy trout and stocking in inland lakes.
Thank you.
ODFMW is currently using existing resources to improve lake and reservoir fisheries. And these efforts have and will continue to yield increased and more diverse angler opportunities. We're doing that without further complicating our regulations, and we're using existing resources to do it. Currently, we have our management for select trophy trout fisheries is directed by the trout management plan that was currently adopted, or that's been adopted by our Fish and Wildlife, the state's Fish and Wildlife Commission, and our in-basin fish management plans. So there are about 2.3 million legal-sized fish stocked annually. In this, as part of that, there are around 100 and 29,000 trout purchased from private facilities as part of that stocking effort of 2.3 million fish. Annually, we release about 160,000 to 200,000 trophy-sized trout. The department, in hearing Representative Esquivel's comment about the big brown trout, where our trophy-sized trout kind of category measurement is a pound to 2.5 pounds. And so the legislation before you gets at raising fish to a much larger size, and they do become more aggressive and in terms of their biting as they reach larger sizes. Our district biologists direct the number of fish that we stock in the local water bodies. They already have the ability to increase the number and the size of trophy trout based on budget constraints and on user demand, public demand for those fisheries. The cost to produce a fish is roughly $3.40 a pound. And so to produce a 5-pound fish, that cost is around $24 a fish, which can be done. Regardless of legislation, the department has the authority to increase and adjust trophy trout numbers and sizes reared at largely at state hatcheries. So within the existing hatchery framework, current staff have the ability to incorporate the additional rearing that would be needed to perform a program like this. It would involve costs. The bill mentions the need for additional angler surveys. Those surveys, at least four at the four pilot lakes that the bill references, would be needed to essentially assess user demand and other factors related to where additional trophy trout stocking would occur. That said, there is a lot of trout stocking that's already occurring. The assessment of the user demand issue is something that would be needed for justifying the expansion of the program. And while ODF&W certainly we would not turn down additional resources to enhance fisheries, the department has developed a fee bill that is based on conversations with our constituents related to what are the priority user demands and how do we fund current program work within considerations of not wanting to price people out of the opportunity to use discretionary dollars to do things such as hunting and fishing and trout fishing such as this. So with that, I'm here for any questions, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very, very much. We'll give Stan a chance to testify before we open it up to questions.
Good morning, Chair Witt, committee members. My name is Stan Steele. I'm here this morning. I handed out a timeline of how I became obsessed with, trout, just fishing. Grew up on the Lieberg Trout Hatchery. My dad was the technician there. 18 years. Moved there when I was one. Moved away when I, went in the service. So trout fishing is something that's really important. It's the number one fishery in Oregon. More people participate in trout fishing than any other of our cold water fisheries or warm water fisheries. The night before trout season, you couldn't sleep. You were excited. You were just really, really ready for spring, because that always happened. It was a spring rite of passage. You caught your worms the night before with the light, or several nights before with the flashlight out of the yard. Rainy nights, the night crawlers came out, and you're out there picking. Actually, we turned that into a kind of a youngster business. We picked, and I think we got 35 cents a dozen.
Dating yourself, Steve.
Yeah, I know it. It's great. McKinsey was the most incredible classroom you could ever have. I learned more life experiences on the banks of the McKinsey with my black lab and my brother, fishing everything from Chinook, but trout always seemed to be the top. The thing about fishing for trout is it's just downright fun. It's accessible to people of all ages, all income, and specifically to kids. It's a great entry-level fishery. And why it's an entry-level fishery is the catch rate. You can go Chinook fishing, and you might fish for days. You go trout fishing, you better be fishing for just minutes before tugging on the end of your string. In here, I mentioned how my mom would just say, Stan, you're obsessed. I mean, you just let it go, will you? It's going to happen in the morning. Well, that's exactly the way it was. It's the way it needs to be for kids all throughout Oregon and the nation. Oregon's angling rate is declining. And with that, there's stress is put on the department's ability to manage all species. The trout plan that Mr. Branscombe referred to, I don't believe has been updated for several decades. We used to have numerous biologists assigned specifically to a trout program in ODFW headquarters. Seven or eight, I believe. I'm not sure there's a specific person assigned to trout management and headquarters now. And I could be wrong, and I hope that I am. So what Mr. McDonald and Joe were talking about a few minutes ago is revitalizing. Representative Escobar said that there are great places in eastern Oregon to catch large trout. And there are in eastern Oregon. What about local lakes in western Oregon? Most accessible to a kid on a bicycle. We do have some of these programs. Alton Baker Pond down in Eugene is a classic example of a urban fishery that is having kids participate. But we've also lost participation in Representative Whitsitt's area by discontinuing stocking in some of our rivers and streams in the Paisley country due to wild trout management. This is all well and good, but we need to replace those opportunities. Those kids need to reconnect. You know, there's a sign of maybe changing times when people say that we're so disconnected that we don't have the ability. Kids just aren't interested anymore. They have too many finger games that they want to play. Well, that's an easy excuse. It's a very easy excuse. And it's not one that I think holds any water at all. Utah has a pamphlet that is this thick on developing blue ribbon trout fisheries. They set up a Blue Ribbon Trout Council. Their governor is the one that actually established this council. Their angling license participations and sales and in participation are increasing. When we de-emphasize, we will lose. And this is a classic example of what we once had and what we now have. Let's talk to McKinsey and catch rates. A few years ago, there was quite a controversy around hatchery stocking in the McKinsey River. McKinsey is my home water. I guided on it after I retired from conservation officer for 12 years. I had people from all over the world come and fish that, what is known as the Princess of the Rivers. They were there to catch primarily a high catch rate. They wanted a high encounter, not one large oversized trout, but many trout during the day. And there were days we would actually land 60 to 70 fish per day on a fly rod. It was great to watch, and they came back year after year. Probably the number one leading recreational sporting event economically and participation rate in Lane County. Actually, it is, from the Dean Runyon Associates Economic Review a few years ago. Just for real quickly, Oregon has 638,000 anglers. They spent 5,658 days fishing in 2011. 71,000 of those anglers from 6 to 15 years of age. They spent $640 million. And they spent an average of $2.5 million a day. Anglers support over 11,000 jobs in Oregon. And those jobs are paying over $515 million in wages. And that economic impact ripples through Oregon's economy at $1.6 billion. So what we have before us today in this House bill is an opportunity to not only enhance that, but to insure it statewide. Why stop with four? During the controversy over the McKinsey, there was a preference survey done. This preference survey was to see what people really wanted out of the McKinsey fishery. And over 80% of respondents wanted it to stay the same or improve. In other words, they wanted the hatchery stocking to remain because of the catch rate. Drifting that river on a daily basis, I actually worked one summer 52 straight days with trips. What I noticed was this. Families of all types and all kinds were fishing every day. You could see them. Kids were smiling. Their Snoopy rods were out. And this is what it's about. So in closing, I think that we aren't charting new waters. Michigan, Missouri, Montana, Utah, Wisconsin, Colorado, and California all have this program established. Their license sales are all increasing. There is a correlation. Opportunity that is a very well-designed opportunity will cause participation to increase. Lessening the impact of a surcharge. Now, this $1 surcharge, $1, and I think a latte is what, $3.50? It's priorities. This is a good bill, and we need to expand opportunities for Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments? I'm not seeing any. Brett, I know that there's folks, we've heard testimony, we've heard your testimony. I know the general sentiment of a number of members here of the committee that we not let license and tag fees get out of hand. And I know that we have specified a surcharge here in the bill. I would just feel more comfortable if a couple of you could chat with Representative Krieger before we work the bill and just make sure that figure, that dollar, is something that reaches a level of comfort with everyone. And Vice Chair Krieger, I don't know if you'd like to comment on that.
I'd like to have just a very basic, broad, doesn't have to be real accurate, but some idea what is the size of the program and the cost of those fish. And then you kind of figure you got four lakes. What is your participation? And if you had a little trophy trout stamp, which is real easy to purchase on a roll, you pull it off, stick it on there, and then we know what we're dealing with, and we can fund it if we want to take part in the program. And I think it would grow.
Pocket money now.
May I respond, Chair?
Please.
Representative Krieger, committee members. You know, that's not that. That's just a great idea, and here's why. Many states have their base angling license. And then to participate in a harvest fishery, you will have a trout stamp. Now, you can participate in the trout fishery as long as you don't harvest with your base angling license. We haven't done that here. It's another opportunity for us to have everyone who just wants to catch and release and also have those who want to harvest support these programs more directly. I think it's just a great idea, and it is one that's being used elsewhere.
And if you take, it's going to cost you a little extra. So that may, he thinks well on his feet. Good job. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think on our license they can just print it out of a little, because you know you get your tags, you get your, you know, your turkey tag, you get your deer tag, you get your elk tag, and all this is listed on your license itself. I think that you can get an endorsement. It'd just be another line in your license. Of course, the license is this long now, but
roll it up.
By the way, Stan, the rest of us didn't have the opportunity you have because, see, we had to go out in the ponds and the rivers to fish, not in the hatchery like you.
I have to admit, Stan, as a youngster, I was chased out of the pond more than once.
Any additional questions or comments? Gentlemen, I appreciate your testimony very much. I appreciate you just checking in with Representative Krieger and make sure we get this right before we work it.
So. Absolutely. We'll do,
okay?
Thank
you very much. Appreciate that. Anyone else from the public who'd like to testify on House Bill 2053 this morning? Seeing no one, I'm going to close the public hearing on that bill. And I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2497. And I would like, well, first of all, while I call up representatives and Senator Whitsitt, I'd like Chuck to remind us what the bill is about.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2497 requires natural resource agencies to provide notice of rulemaking to members of the Legislative Assembly under certain circumstances.
Thank you very much. Good morning to both of you. Senator, please excuse me. I thought maybe the testimony might have gone very quickly on the previous bill, and I know we kept you waiting here a little longer than I anticipated.
Good morning.
Please proceed. Good morning.
Chair Witt and committee members, I'm Gail Whitsitt. I represent House District 56, which is the southern half of Klamath and Lake Counties to the California border. We're bringing you House Bill 2497, which is a bill to require Oregon Administrative Branch natural resource agencies to provide notice of rulemaking to members of the legislature when the agency intends to adopt, amend, or repeal a rule, the effect of which will apply only to a particular geographic area or areas of the state. In other words, if an agency promulgates new rules, they must advise the elected state senator or representatives of the area affected 49 days before the intended action is to take effect. Right now, the law says that the rule is to be put out there in general rulemaking 49 days, but they don't have to tell the legislators from the area. This is necessary, in my opinion, because it's apparent over the last decade that I've been associated with the legislature, that several agencies are undertaking bureaucratic agendas through the rulemaking process that precludes either the legislature or the citizens from being a part of the decision-making process. Our governmental structure has been carefully laid out to provide for three equal branches of government. We all know this, the executive, the judicial, and the legislative. Rulemaking has become a method for the executive or administrative branch to usurp the powers given to the legislative branch. Due to this overreaching in certain geographic locations within the state, we as legislators often find ourselves without knowledge of newly made policies disguised as rules. It is the express constitutional duty of the legislative branch to make policy, not the administrative branch. This bill should assist in making sure that we, as the elected leaders of our districts, know and can plan for public input into any rules before they are placed into law. Senator Whitsitt, who is a co-sponsor, will provide examples of recent incidents of rulemaking without adequate notice to elected state district legislators. I'd like to say that this morning when I got into my office, there was a call at 5:02 last night after my staff had left from the governor's office wanting to know if a question regarding if this applies to emergency or temporary rules. Then at 6:50 this morning, before we were in, I got this email which asked the same thing. This proposed legislation has been out since January. January 12th, it was put out for public consumption, if you will. Mm-hmm. And it's been scheduled for quite a length of time. And I just want to put on the record that I really, really resent having someone call at 5:02 last night and 6:50 this morning when no one's in my office to ask a question about it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. I'm, for the record, I'm Senator Doug Whitsett, representing District 28, which is Klamath Crook, most of Lake, Deschutes, and Jackson counties. Mr. Chair, natural resource agencies often initiate rulemaking that affects regional areas of the state, sometimes only a legislative district. Too often, the agencies initiate the action without notifying legislators whose areas will be affected. Legislators may not be aware of the agency's intention to initiate rulemaking, even though the agency may have followed all the rules required for proper notice before taking action. According to the Secretary of State Archives Division, Oregon has an estimated 43,000 administrative rules. More than 15,000 either new or temporary administrative rules are created, amended, or deleted each biennium. That calculates to about 30 rules changes every business day of every week of every month of every year. Mr. Chair, one rule change about every 15 minutes. I submit that no legislator has the resources to follow all of the rulemaking performed by Oregon state agencies. House Bill 2497 simply requires the natural resources agencies, there's 13 of them, to notify relevant legislators regarding their intention to promulgate rules that only affect the legislator's district or region. Now, please allow me to give you four examples. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife creates mule deer winter habitat regulations within specific areas by rule. These designations have extreme effects on the subsequent allowable use of property within the designated habitat area. Too often, landowners suffer significant property value losses without even knowing that intended use has occurred. That is, until they attempt to make a change of the use of the property or to sell the property. Each of these designations is specific to a legislative district or geographic area. The second example, the Oregon Water Resources Department recently initiated rulemaking regarding the use of groundwater in the Upper Klamath River Basin. The action was legally noticed, but virtually no one in the area was even aware of the agency's intent. I only became aware of it when I was informed by a constituent of a notice in a local newspaper announcing a public hearing that evening regarding the rulemaking. I determined the scope of the rule from the agency, and then, with the help of the county commissioner, was able to spread the word. In the absence of that alert from our constituent, virtually no one would have testified at this critically important Water Resources Commission hearing in Klamath Falls because no one knew it was going to happen. This rule only applied to my legislative district. Last fall, the Department of State Lands determined that it needed to create emergency rules excluding the public from large areas of Lake and Harney counties, allegedly to protect tribal artifacts. The rule was allegedly made necessary by drought that caused shallow lakes to go dry, exposing large areas of previously unexposed lake beds. Director Mary Abrams called to inform me of the agency's intent, and we very much appreciate that heads up. At that time, I conveyed my deep concerns regarding the extent of the proposed rule, as well as my certainty that it would be vigorously opposed by county residents. I underestimated that fierce opposition. The agency initiated the emergency rule as planned. However, it has already been rescinded, primarily due to the magnitude of the opposition and some wet weather that, that created some mud flats instead of dry flats. Director Abrams' notification was timely, appropriate, and served to alert the agency that most county residents thought the rule was both unneeded and inappropriate. The temporary rule affected one region of the state, represented by myself, Representative Whitsett, Representative Benz, Representative McLean, and Senator Ferrioli. My fourth example is a little off the target, but it's I think it makes a strong point. I was concerned last year that the Oregon Water Resources Department might be contemplating issuing a water right for 175,000 acre-feet of in-stream flow in the Klamath River for the alleged benefit of the threatened coho salmon. To put that into perspective, that amount of water will irrigate about 80,000 acres of cropland. That flow is currently mandated by a federal biological opinion. It is uncertain to me how running 75-degree or 80-degree water out of Upper Klamath Lake during the summertime down the river for the benefit of the coho salmon is going to help those salmon. I think if you leave a coho in the 80-degree water long enough, it'll cook him. Nonetheless, the former Oregon Water Resources Department director sat in my Senate office and assured me that the department had no intention of issuing such a water right, none whatsoever. 2 days later, the Oregon Water Resources Department issued a limited license for 175,000 acre-feet of in-stream flow down the Klamath River for the benefit of the coho salmon. Mr. Chair, technically, the director did not mislead me. I did not ask him the right question. Mr. Chair, committee members, all this bill does is to require the agencies to give the legislators a heads up before they initiate rulemaking that will exclusively affect only the legislator's direct district or region. And I would like to draw your attention to line 10 of the bill. And this is the part where it talks about the 49, that notice must be given within 49 days. This may or may not be appropriate, an appropriate time limit for a temporary rule. And we would be amenable to a amendment that would fix that alleged problem. I too am a little concerned about the timing of that. However, I mean, it is possible that somebody didn't see it until the last moment. But nonetheless, if that needs to be fixed, we'd certainly be amenable to that fix. Thank you.
Please.
I would like to describe from statute 183.335, the definition of temporary rule or emergency rule. Quote, temporary emergency rules may be adopted only if agency finds failure to act promptly will result in serious prejudice to public interest or interest of parties. Without such showing, temporary rules are invalid. So what I don't want to see is if we pass this law, suddenly everything becomes temporary or emergency in the rulemaking process, which is what I really fear if we don't set some sideboards on this, because in my opinion, the agencies just want to go around the legislature to achieve what is essentially new policy, and that is policy is what we are here for, not the administrative branch. That is what the legislature was elected to do. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments, Vice Chair McLean?
Well, I just, you know, you've been very clear and very specific examples, and I appreciate what you're bringing before us, because I think it's important when we're representing folks to be able to be in the know so that we can be representatives. And the one question I did have is whether it be 49 days or anything else, is there some kind of it's a notice, that's it, they have to notice you, but is there any kind of process for that in session, out of session? I was just thinking about you know, how does that work? How are they going to notice you? Do we need to be more specific or put sideboards on what the notice means?
Well, I personally would like a written notice, as in an email or through the mail. But, you know, I don't want to have somebody say, I called and left a message on your phone, and then who knows if the message was ever left or not. You know, I mean, you've been there before, so.
So my comment was just I thought written notice was most appropriate.
Yeah, I think so.
Thank you. Representative Esquivel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that we can have emails sent to us, and if they can't get a hold of us via email, something's wrong with the whole system. But on the other hand, they can put a check and balance in there that if you opened it up, it tells them that you have opened that email. Mm-hmm. So there's no excuse for not notifying us as elected officials.
Any other members?
Just a comment.
Vice Chair Krieger, please.
Thank you. If you live underneath the administrative rules, because you have forest land, ag land, you're a producer in some way, or a consumer, Department of Fish and Wildlife has administrative rules. there is a quagmire of bureaucracy that nobody can wade through. And it, where it really gets bad is where the agencies have sort of dual authority. And each one of them wants to be the chief. And they haven't worked it out yet who's going to have the final say. So I've been at issues along streams. You had state parks, Division of State Lands, you had the Corps, federal, and you had Department of Fish and Wildlife. So you got four or five agencies there looking at something, all of them having a role, and the person who has the land that maybe is being washed away by the river from high water is trying to figure out who has the authority to tell me what. If it had my way, administrative rules would go away, period, and we do like a lot of states do. You got an idea, bring it to the legislature, we'll make the policy. What we've got now in Oregon is just a pathway, I think, to special interest groups and behind-the-scenes maneuvering.
Chair, what Representative Krieger, and, no, just an example, I agree with it entirely. Several years ago, a levee washed out along Upper Klamath Lake and flooded a field and part of the Running Y golf course and so forth. It went on for months, and we couldn't figure out what was necessary to repair the, you know, within the law, what was necessary to repair the levee. So we summoned the state and federal agencies, we thought all the ones that might be involved, to the Running Y Resort. And we started at 9 o'clock in the morning, worked through a working lunch till 4 in the afternoon. And the only thing that we were tasked to do was to determine what rules had to be followed to fix the deck. The people could not answer the questions. So you're absolutely right.
In the end, Mr. Chair, it got done.
Yeah.
And there was not a clear process of making a very timely decision. Mm-hmm. And somebody should be the lead agency. This is what we're going to do. We're going to start tomorrow morning. And this is the environmental things we're going to have to deal with.
Yes. It was like a one-day and a half fix, you know, to get it done. And the other thing I would bring out is that we talk about all those rules and all the different layers of rules from different agencies, but it's a moving target. They're amending one of these rules every 15 minutes. So how could anyone possibly know if they're really staying within the law, because the law is constantly changing? So,
yeah. May I?
Yes, please.
It's not our intention to prevent a response to a natural disaster emergency. I just want to make that clear. But that is not what a lot of these rules are being advanced for. It's to make policy, which is our job. Thank you.
Calls to mind a couple of military anachronisms. Vice Chair McLean.
We keep looking for ways to make sure the public understand how the work is done. And so I find this to be just the minimum transparency necessary to allow your elected official to know what's going on in your community. And I applaud you for this type of work. Thank you.
Anyone else? I just want to assure you that you're not the only two that have ever been caught by surprise. The public does look to us as folks who are supposed to be informed. And when we're not, it's embarrassing. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I can speak for this entire committee, but I'm sensing there are a number of us who have been in similar positions. Mm-hmm. And I want to say that I have had a couple of people come to me who questioned the need for this bill. And I think there is a difference between our having a right to request information and an agency that really takes it seriously, that everything be transparent. And I'll give you an example of what I consider to be very good government. And it's not rulemaking, but it's notification when penalties are assessed, and it's DEQ. I have never been aware of a single penalty being levied in my district that DEQ hasn't first written me a letter and then followed up with a phone call to explain exactly what was going on, what their findings were, what the questions were during the hearing, and on and on and on. Now, I'm not suggesting that every single rule notification has to go to that extent, but I would say that there is a vast difference between DEQ's approach to making sure that that legislator in that district who has an affected employer is just light years of difference from, well, you know, if they want to know, they can ask us. So I am one who I favor this bill, and I hope that our agencies take a lesson from DEQ, that it really helps us be better as legislators. And quite frankly, if I have an employer who's upset with a fine that DEQ has levied, the fact that I know the reasons why that fine was imposed in the first place often helps me come to the aid of the agency as well. So, I mean, if we just scratch each other's back just a little bit, I think it enables all of us to do our jobs that much better. So, anyways, my two cents worth. Anything further? Yes, Representative Barreto, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there, you know, just what Chair Witt mentioned, do the different agencies have different criteria that they fall under as far as speaking to the different entities involved, as far as does Fish and Wildlife have a different responsibility to the landowners than what DEQ would have to businesses?
Chair Witt, Representative Barreto, to my knowledge, there is no standard for what an agency is supposed to do. I agree with Chair Witt that although I don't always agree with what DEQ does, DEQ is very transparent with what they do. That's not true of other agencies. You know, the Department of Transportation is one of these natural resource agencies, and some of the decisions they make on right-of-ways and so forth are very, very intrusive on people. And I think that if they make such a decision, it was just a courtesy call or a courtesy email to let us know what's going on and why they did that. Usually an agency has a reason for doing it, and sometimes that's really not apparent to us. And it's really sometimes not apparent to the landowner or to, you know, the person being fined. But I think that it's... But specifically to answer your question, I don't think there's, to my knowledge, there are no guidelines within administrative rules that says that an agency must do this or that.
Well, I'm thinking if there's going to be a change and it's going to affect the landowner, then they should contact the landowner as well as the representative or senator. And this happened where I live. I live in an elk wintering ground, and they decided it was going to be an elk wintering ground, and they put a 3-day public notice in the paper. And this was back in the 80s, I think, and no one knew about it. And then same thing, they went to sell their property, and you can't do things.
Yeah, Chair Witt, Representative Barreto, yes, they take a marks a lot and say, there, that looks good. And everything inside that circle or that irregular circle suddenly has a great deal less land value.
That's correct.
Could I?
Please.
I would just like to say that my frustration with these questions coming in last night at 5:02 and at 6:50 this morning is that one of the things I would have done had I had the questions earlier in advance of my testimony is I would have found out in my district the numbers of emergency or temporary rules versus regular rules, so I could have told you and looked them all up to see, you know, what we were looking at. So I know we're going to have agencies come say, well, we just can't have emergency or temporary rules fall under this. But if I'd had the questions in any amount of time, I would have been happy to have provided that with you as an argument for or against or in support or not, but I just didn't have enough time finding out 5 minutes before committee started.
Well, the lessons to be learned here, communication is good. The fact that we're all informed helps all of us to do our jobs better. We may even be able to help those who are looking for the rules changes. And the kind of courtesy that DEQ exhibits in terms of its notification is just that, it's a courtesy. And we could all be well advised to take that kind of courtesy to heart. Seeing nothing further, Representative Senator, thank you very, very much. Appreciate that. I'd like to call forward now, please, Peggy Lynch and Paul Garahan. Good morning and welcome to you both.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan, grassroots political organization that encourages the informed and active participation in government. And I want to make that comment again. It encourages the informed and active participation in government. The League believes that broad-based participation in agency rulemaking means that any adopted rules are more likely to more accurately reflect legislative intent and provide the best possible outcomes. The League shares notices of rulemaking with members and with others and has supported agencies' maintenance of email notice lists so that all can be informed of agency actions. We appreciate the Senator and Representative for bringing the issue of rulemaking forward. Everyone needs to know that rulemaking happens, that the policies that you make are then implemented by agencies. So we certainly encourage everyone to be a part. However, this committee, probably more than any except Ways and Means, knows the costs and burdens of natural resource agencies. And it is because of that we have opposed this particular bill. Not that we do not want everyone to know. We encourage every lawmaker to sign up for the email notices from every agency, and you can do that. It is very simple. I get those same DEQ notices, even though I don't have a particular reason to know that, but it's simply because I'm on the DEQ list. It is easy for those DEQ people to respond to a particular legislator because it's a specific address. What this bill says is that they would have to know whether their rule might affect a particular subset of the state. And that's where the burden, the staff burden, I think, occurs. I was going to see if there were a couple of other things. So that's the issue. So a geographic area is different than a legislative area. And so how would they know which one to do? We want everyone to receive notices of rulemaking and to participate. But we are concerned with the burden on the agencies related to this particular bill. And there is a whole ORS 183.3335 provides an entire set of responsibilities for agencies to give notice of intended action. So I believe it's there. We just need to make sure that we make sure that all of our all of Oregon's citizens know the opportunity to be able to participate in the rulemaking process. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Witt, members of the committee, I'm Paul Garahan. I'm the attorney in charge of the Natural Resources Section in the General Counsel Division at the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here this morning at the request of the Governor's Natural Resources Office. Simply, and to be clear, the Department of Justice is not taking a position on this bill. It's neutral on the bill. We're not making any statement on the policy choice that you have to make regarding this matter. We simply wanted to make sure on the issue that has already been discussed about the effect that the bill would have on temporary rulemaking. Because this is a standalone bill that is not made part of ORS 183-335, which is the rulemaking notice statute, it would affect temporary rules, as has been discussed here, and so the notice under the current language would require 49 days notice ahead of that. I can offer just a couple examples of some agencies and when they use temporary rules that I wanted to make sure should be part of the consideration. The Department of Agriculture, for example, in the bird flu incidences, had to establish quarantine areas, and they did so through temporary rulemaking. And then I know that the Department of Fish and Wildlife also frequently uses temporary rulemaking to very closely control certain fisheries, to open opportunities or close opportunities based on the information they have and the science on the ground. And that can be for very short periods of time to either offer opportunities or to protect fisheries when needed. I know that there are representatives of the department here, and they could offer more information about that. So, not to speak to the policy, but to make sure that the committee is thinking about that and considering what the appropriate notice would be. There are situations, and not all temporary rules affect issues that are of critical importance that it has to go into effect that day. There can be different situations where certain notice could be allowed, but I guess I would submit that there are some situations where it's used where contemporaneous notice might be the appropriate notice. We would be happy to work with legislative counsel in thinking about this. The other option, currently under standard rulemaking notice, just to be clear, notice is provided, and the 49 days is the notice that's required by email right now in the notice provision to go at least to the chairs of the committees that oversee the area affected in the legislature. And also, if the rulemaking is implementing a bill that was passed within the prior 2 years, notice also has to go to the bill's sponsors. I want to make sure I get the language right. The legislator who introduced the bill, it also needs to get notice. So that's the legislative notice right now that's provided to the legislature for regular rulemaking. If this provision were inserted into ORS 183-335, then that would have the effect that you could insert it into subsection 15, and the effect would be that it would not apply to temporary rules. The other option is to think about what notice is appropriate to legislators in a specific area when a rule affects that area. Yes. for a temporary rule. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Garahan, very much. That helps clarify some of my own thinking.
Sal has a question.
Vice Chair McLean, followed by Representative Escobel.
Well, first of all, I appreciate both of your opinions and your comments today as far as, how this affects doing good business and best practices. And I want to thank Peggy, who I've known for like 25,000 years, as far as really that long. And I really want to thank her because she used to live in Beaverton and now she lives in Corvallis. And it's a situation where she's always very conscientious and her organization is conscientious of making sure the public knows. And so I appreciate those comments. And I don't think the sponsor or anybody else wants it to cost too much money or for it to be a burden or anything else. But I think that what I heard Peggy say was she wants everybody to be informed. Well, quite frankly, either a sponsor or a chair is not going to help me with a particular business who's getting something changed for their way to do business. And quite frankly, with only 90 legislators and the amount of things that go through our desk and through email, we're asking for more of an active notification. And I think that that's, where this piece of legislation has some real merit. To your comment, though, as far as temporary versus, one that's going to be more standing or standard. Is there anything else that needs to happen besides, is there a definitional issue between the temporary emergency and the standard type of rulemaking that you think could be cleaned up at the same time to offer more clarity about what's the difference between temporary and your standard type of rulemaking?
Chair Witt, Vice Chair McLean, there are specific standards right now for temporary rulemaking. The agency has to make findings and find that its failure to act promptly will result in serious prejudice to the public interest or the interest of the parties concerned, and the specific reasons for its findings of prejudice. That's the most significant one. And then it has to cite its authority, include a statement of need, and list what documents it relied on. And there are some other more specific, in some instances,
so it's there.
Requirements. So there are standards.
Okay.
In my experience, the agencies in determining when to use temporary rules, my experience is they make that judgment. For the most part, they make that judgment correctly.
Okay.
About when they actually do have authority and there is a situation that calls for temporary rules. Mm-hmm. That's separate from your policy decision on what kind of notice should be provided.
Okay.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we all here would just like to have notification of what's happening in your district. I think that's what this amounts to. Doesn't matter. No one's going to circumvent a temporary order, an emergency order. We are correct. DEQ is the only one that really reaches out and lets us know what's going on in our districts. And I really appreciate that. But no one else does. And I think that's the point we're trying to get across here. Maybe I misunderstood you, Peggy, but I thought you said something about the rules may affect other areas that the people are making the rules with kind of unintended consequences. Is that correct?
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, what I was getting at was that there is a difference between a legislative district and a geographic area that a rule might apply to. So it makes it more difficult. It's not as if rules follow legislative lines. Rules follow particular issues and areas dependent upon what the rule relates to. And so asking for a specific notice by agencies to determine that this particular rule is going to affect your district and your district may be more difficult than the elk discussion that was had. Those elk lines don't follow a particular district. They follow the elk, presumed where the elk are supposed to be. And that's the burden that I'm seeing, is that if in fact this rule, this particular legislation goes into effect, then an agency will have to do one of two things. It's either going to have to notify you every time they do a rule, period, which is fine with me. I think that's a great idea. Or they're going to have to figure out, is this rule going to affect you? Is it going to affect you? And which legislator should I notice about this? And the DEQ notice really is different related to the penalties, because it is address specific. They can put it in a map and they can say, and this is in your district.
Well, so
that's the difference.
I would think, though, that if we're going to make rules here in our bureaucratic body, then I would assume that we would know whether it's going to affect five of us or six of us. I mean, we better know that or we shouldn't be doing the rules.
Additional questions or comments?
I want to follow up on that.
Yes, Vice Chair McLean,
I think,
please.
I really feel like we're all saying the same thing, mm-hmm. and I think, Peggy, you are too, and that is the sense that notification is good. And not only is notification good, but, erring on the part that if you say, this might affect five legislators or it might affect seven, err on the side of notifying seven. Because, I mean, you know what your issue is. You know what region is going to be covered. It's either going to be a particular, region by water or a region by species or, region by law enforcement, whatever it is. There's going to be, some kind of a distinguishing factor. But I think we're all saying the same thing, and it sounds like we all have a lot of work to do to try to make this work, because to me it's transparency. It's how the state does business. And if it's a legislative body or whether it is an administrative rule that's going to carry out a something the legislative body has said, we've got to make it make sense. And we've got to be able to do our job. So I think you folks will be absolutely important to this process on making sure that we do this correctly and that we provide for transparency, that we provide for notice for representatives and senators that are trying to represent, and that we're trying to make sure that the public understands the process of work. So I really support this, and I really thank you for your comments today, but I don't see them as barriers. I see them only as instructive of what we need to do to get this to function.
Thank you very much. Mr. Garahan, I noted that you had offered to make yourself available to discuss a possible amendment, and I know Representative Whitsitt, you had indicated your openness to that, and so when we have a little work group put together, if the representative could feel open to discussing with you, I would appreciate that very much.
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, I'd look forward to that. Thank you.
Thank you both very, very much. Thank appreciate you. Your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else from the public who would like to testify today on House Bill? Please come forward.
Chair Witt, Committee for the Record, Bill Clooney, Carpenters Industrial Council. I like this bill, and I'll tell you why. I'll give you one small example. One time, Oregon had one grade of lumber. And from outside this country, a new grade of lumber was formed, FSC, which is Forest Sustainable Stewardship, or LEEDS. And we, most of all of Oregon, 90% of the timber growers, even the state, was classified under sustainable forestry. One of the directors in the Department of Energy put in an administrative rule adopting LEEDS certified lumber only for state public building. And we've been fighting this for 15 years. Right after she put this administrative rule in, she left the Department of Energy and became a vice president of LEEDS in the Northwest. The state was caught off guard. The state timber was demoted down to where it couldn't be used in state public buildings. Every private owner, and Representative Crager probably found out. Now, everybody had to jump through the hoops. They tried to find out who is LEEDS, how it worked. So they had to go back to school and prove that their timber was satisfying LEEDS. Meanwhile, lumber in these state public buildings had to come in from out of state or other countries. Chair Witt, committee, you people deserve to know these administrative rules that affect people in Oregon. You've heard in the news lately we need a transparent government. And I'd like to know the expense that we've went through fighting this new classification of lumber, not just here in Oregon, but nationwide. Everybody jumped on the bandwagon, LEEDS only. Well, three-fourths of these states have backed out. It just didn't work. We still have big cities that are locked into leads only. Somehow we're getting around it. Our lumber is gradually working its way into this market. But if you folks would have had an idea that this bill was going to be administrative rule was going to come into effect, this wouldn't have happened. And I'll just stop right there. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? Vice Chair Krieger.
What you just heard is what's promoted by the environmental for-profit industry that hurts Oregon.
Any other questions or comments? Not seeing any. Bill, thank you very, very much. I appreciate that. Last and final call, public testimony on House Bill 2497. Seeing none, hearing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on that bill. And we're going to move into a work session on House Bill 2534. I'm going to open a work session on that bill. And Mr. Gallagher, if you can remind the committee, please, what this bill entails.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the bill directs State and Fish and Wildlife Commission to adopt rules prohibiting the use of drones for angling or hunting or for interfering with lawful angling and hunting, and allows an exemption for the Department of Fish and Wildlife or department's agents from prohibition subject to certain requirements and restrictions.
Thank you very much. Committee members, we have four amendments, dashes 1 through 4, on this bill. Dash 4 is a comprehensive amendment. It contains the other three, dash 1, 2, and 3. Just for your remind you, the dash 1 deletes reference to tracking in the bill and adds tracking, trapping, or locating, so it makes the coverage more comprehensive. The dash 2 amendment makes the bill not applicable to commercial fishing laws. You may remember the testimony that we received that drones are used by commercial fishermen, or fishers, I guess, to haze birds, among other things. And then the dash 3 amendments largely exclude beneficial aspects of hazing for protection of wildlife management. They could be used for habitat and protection of property. Now, I'm not entirely sure that involves hunting or fishing, but anyways, the work group felt that was important to make everyone comfortable, and I think that for that reason alone, it probably makes sense. And then the dash 4 amendment, of course, includes all three of those amendments in one. With that, any questions at this point before I recognize Vice Chair Krieger? Not seeing. Yes, Representative Esquivel.
On this discussion, did we ever discuss the fact that the Department of Fish and Wildlife, they have they have an exempt from this, but does that mean that they will be using it to monitor what people are doing on the river or doing hunting? And you know what that means?
Well, it talks about those things that would benefit wildlife management. So
things management purposes.
Yeah. So
surveys, that type of thing.
I can't answer that directly.
that's the first thing I thought of when I read it.
Yeah.
That's because you're guilty.
They can watch me.
Anyone from the department want to respond to that?
I don't think he wants to.
Brett, good morning.
Good morning. Chair Witt, members of the committee, Representative Esquivel, Brett Brownscombe, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. So, Rep. Esquivel, the intent there is to keep options open for potential use of the technology in doing things that benefit wildlife management while lowering safety risks, lowering expenses to the department. It's not to, certainly not to give the department authority to spy on people.
So that's a no.
Yeah, well, I mean, I could even, to both of you, as I'm sitting here, I'm just thinking, I salmon fish regularly on the Columbia River, and oftentimes the department does aerial surveys of the number of fishers on the river, and it's typically by small single-engine airplane, and maybe they may choose to do that similar type of thing with a drone in the future. So I don't think it's, you know, it's not intended to be spying. It's for the benefit of wildlife management in this instance, I think.
Yeah, so. And thank you, Chair Witt, for that. In addition, helicopters and airplanes are used and have been used for years in hunting or big game surveys. And there have been incidents and fatalities and injuries related to that. So there is some desire to have the conversation about, is there a way to not only reduce expenses but also promote the safety of promote human safety considerations in how the department collects data. But obviously this is a conversation that needs to happen openly, and that relates to the conversations we've been having around rulemaking. And but the intent is to keep the option open and not foreclose it in statute.
And in the intent, I assume, is not to interfere with the hunting or fishing.
That's right. Yeah. There are dual purposes. As we read the bill, there are dual purposes, and that is one is to fair chase and fair chase ethics, but also to prevent the use of the technology to interfere or harass people who are engaged legally in hunting and fishing. And those dual prongs are the way we read the bill in terms of its fundamental core tenets.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair McLean.
I'm sure that if there was any rulemaking going on that issue, though, that there would be discussion and notification of folks that it might affect. I mean, that's the whole idea, is that it's great to have that opportunity left open, but if we want to be able to tell the public what's going on, we have to know what's going on. So, I mean, I think these conversations connect. But I don't see it as being a problem with this particular piece of legislation.
Absolutely. Chair Witt and Vice Chair McLean, we would certainly as a department intend to, and I can provide, and I think based on the testimony on House Bill 2497, I will provide in writing what the department currently does related to its rulemaking and notification of legislators affected or potentially affected, just to clarify what we currently do. But we would certainly intend to have very open, transparent communications with the legislature and the public around any potential rulemaking if the technology were used for those purposes.
All right. Anything further? Brett, thank you very much. That was very helpful clarification. Appreciate that.
Sure.
Anything further before I recognize Vice Chair Krieger? Vice Chair Krieger.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the House Bill 2534-4 amendments dated 3/6/15.
Representative Krieger moves to adopt the -4 amendments to House Bill 2534 dated March 6th, 2015. Is there any discussion on his motion? I'm seeing none. Is there any objection to that motion? Seeing none, hearing none, the -4 amendments are adopted. Vice Chair Krieger again, please.
Mr. Chair Witt, I move House Bill 2534 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves House Bill 2534 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on his motion? Seeing none and hearing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Moreno.
Aye.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Representative Forsyth.
Yes.
Representative McEwen.
Aye.
Representative Litzett.
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Vice Chair McLean.
Aye.
Chair Witt.
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, the motion passes. And committee members, if there's no objection, yes, Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I think what we, and I keep looking over and over and over again of how we go to the same well to pull the water out for revenue stream, and we need to figure out a way where everyone in the state of Oregon pays their share of the wildlife, because the wildlife belongs to everyone in the state of Oregon. It doesn't belong just to the hunters or the people that fish. It belongs to everyone, and the trappers. But we need to figure out some sort of vehicle so people that, and what I see all the time is I see that, and I think Stan said it real well, we buy the car, and then somebody comes in and wants to steer it that's never bought the car. And so I'd like to see us figure out a way to increase that revenue and disperse it out among the whole population.
There we go. Thank you very much for that comment. Committee members, if there's no objection, I'm going to assign myself to carry that bill. All right. And with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2534. Anything for the good of the order at this point? Mr. Gallagher, coming events?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Thursday we will be having a public hearing on House Bill 2207, which requires vessels with empty ballast tanks to undergo saltwater flushing of those tanks before entering waters of the state, and House Bill 3197, which establishes State Fish and Wildlife Commission nominating committee to assist the governor in appointing members to the State Fish and Wildlife Commission. And we have three work sessions scheduled on House Bill 3012, which regards the Oregon Hatchery Research Center Fund, House Bill 3013, which allows the establishment of wildlife food plots, and House Bill 2453, which requires organizers to obtain a permit from the State Forestry Department prior to conducting large commercial events on state forest lands.
All right. With that, thank you. So that everybody knows and everybody's on fair notice, I'm going to have to play a little bit of hardball at this point. We've gotten to the point in the session, second week of March. Folks need to be ready with their bills. If you have a bill before this committee, and we call on you, and you tell us that bill is not ready to be heard, from this point forward, your priority goes to the bottom, okay? Just so that everybody understands. I tried to schedule a bill for today's hearing with Mr. Gallagher, who's tried three times now with the sponsors of a particular bill to schedule it for hearing. We were told for the third time it's not ready. That bill is at the bottom of the priority list as of now. And folks, if you have a bill and you want it heard,
better work it.
Be ready, because we're going to be moving bills here very quickly from this point forward. And I'm sorry I have to be that hard-nosed, but that's the way it is from this point forward. Okay. Fair warning, fair notice. Thank you all very much. I appreciate it. It's been a good day. We are adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Hard-Nose. Chair Hard-Nose. Thank you, Mr.